Hey everybody, Sean here. What you're about to hear is a recording from the Independent Labor Club of New York's public assembly that took place on Friday, May 30th at NYU. This was a public assembly, an educational event featuring local teachers, local unionists within the education industry, our public assembly on education and labor. So do enjoy and know that coming this Sunday, so Sunday, June 8th, is going to be at Talon Bar in Ridgewood, Queens, New York, a public meeting where we'll be doing ILC business. We'll also be discussing recent updates from the various different committees within the ILC. And it's a great time if you're in the New York City area to come down to say hello and to start getting involved in meetings and information and social events and all that good stuff. So if you're interested, come by. Alternately, you can go to our website and sign up if you're in New York or outside of New York, outside of the United States even, at ilclabor.com. We'll include that link in the show description. Anyways, do enjoy this public assembly recording on education and labor in New York City. Thank you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to our panel tonight. I'm Davis. I'm just going to introduce the panel. I wanted to start and thank the NYU Philosophy Club for hosting us. And now let me introduce the ILC. The Independent Labor Club is a civil society organization that aims to bring together working people. Our New York City chapter hosts regular events, such as a monthly bowling night, bad movie night, panels such as tonight's, and many other special events. Find us on Instagram at ILC of NYC or our website www.ilclabor.com. Tonight's panel is about education and labor. Education in the U.S. is at a crossroads. In recent months, the Trump administration has proposed to abolish the Department of Education and has threatened to rescind federal grants to universities across the country unless they accede to its demands. Meanwhile, public education continues to lose ground to charter and private schools, where unionization rates are much lower. As lawmakers consider providing vouchers and tax credits in the name of school choice, teachers and professors at every level face increased precarity, lower pay, larger class sizes, and deteriorating work conditions, even as their political speech off the job comes under greater scrutiny. The Independent Labor Club is therefore inviting educators at every level to this panel and town hall tonight. Our moderator tonight is public school teacher Jake Kinsey, who I will let introduce himself.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for coming out tonight. In school, I'm known as Jake. I used to be known as Mr. Kinsey, but you know how permissive liberalism is. Just a joke. So I guess I'm going to introduce myself, and then I'll ask the panelists to introduce themselves, and then we'll get into the questions. I'm a co-worker with two of the other panelists here. We teach at a school on the Upper West Side. We teach high school. It's a public school. And my current job is special education teacher. I guess my degree says I can teach 7 to 12 all major subjects, and that would be kind of a fraud. So currently I teach science, but looking to teach history next year.
Hi, everyone. My name is Michael. The kids I teach call me Teacher Mike. I am a first-year teacher at a charter school up in Harlem. First time doing something like this. Super excited, a little nervous. Thank you for having me.
Hi, everybody. So my name is Ross Wolf, but tonight I'm actually, just to be clear, I'm a public school teacher. I also am a learning specialist, which means I can teach any number of subjects. But right now I'm teaching AP World History, a research methods class, and I'm hoping to do that, for the years coming forward. But tonight I'm actually representing my wife, who's not able to be here. She is no longer a teacher, but for 15 years she worked in private schools around New York City and in Los Angeles. And I'm reading her prepared remarks. So for anything that might come up later, I will provide my own remarks, but for the most part, I'm just representing her. So,
hi, I'm Tom Quick, a colleague of Jake's and Ross's at that Upper West Side public school. It's a 6th through 12th school. I teach in the high school English, and it is not my first career. I'm a career changer coming from the art world, which is its own set of working conditions.
Hi, my name is Alexander King. I teach at the university level, so I teach at the New School and NYU as a part-time faculty. I teach game design, and I'm also in the union at both schools is ACT-UOW 7902, and I'm the staff data analyst for my union. So representing, I guess, the university level of education here.
And my name is Lauren Wolf, no relation to Ross that I know of, but I work for an organization called the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, which is a continuing education institute for adult learners. My specialization as a scholar and a teacher is literature in the German and Austrian milieu, though I am also a full-time administrator at the Brooklyn Institute. So I have two kinds of hats that I wear there and interface with the students and think about our curriculum in a variety of different ways. So I'm glad to be here.
Awesome. So our first question is, what are your current working conditions like as an educator? And what are some of the challenges that you face on an everyday basis?
Hello. All right, cool. So I think there are two big things I want to focus on. There is my experience as a teacher, and there's also kind of the experience of the kids and what they're kind of bringing to the table. I work in a charter school. So that means we are privatized, our specific school lacks a union, and we have a lot of new teachers. There are some great teachers at my school. There are those that have been there for 10 beyond years. I myself am one of the many that is a first year, new to the profession in every way. To be a teacher at a charter school, you do not need any sort of certificate. The only thing you need is to have a college degree. I graduated Brooklyn College, my bachelor's in science. They said, you can do math, that's good enough. Not a joke. With that comes a lot of on-the-job training, which can be quite difficult for the teachers, but I'll get to this later with actually the academic outcomes, but not great for the kids. With the new teachers, figuring it out, there's a lot of turnover, which is also not great. A lot of instability in terms of staffing. Teachers will often have to do the jobs of other people. We are on in front of a classroom like four periods in a day. We are on for bathroom duty, on for pretty much anything you have to do in front of a kid. Bathroom duty, hall monitor, arrival, dismissal, lunch, recess, all of it. Also, we're overworked and lack a lot of time to do this stuff, like lesson planning, grading, all that stuff. And with new teachers, that's difficult to manage. As far as the classes themselves, I teach ACT Math. Basically, I co-teach two cohorts, special education. Normally in school, you're going to have like 30% of the class is going to have an IEP. Basically, kids that have special needs that could be academic or behavioral. In my class, we have 50%. That may not sound like a lot, but when you are managing a class with different needs, both academic and behavioral, you can have a kid that you are trying to teach to read and another kid that has opposite sort of defiance disorder. What that looks like is you are circling around a room, you're kneeling down at a kid's table trying to show them how to annotate questions, also trying to get other kids to sit down. And with new teachers, that is very difficult. If I were to kind of summarize this all and kind of put it in one thing, basically my working conditions that makes it difficult is the lack of training.
All right. So just to reiterate, I am speaking as Susanna Grossman, not as myself. All right. So tellingly, I am no longer an educator currently, precisely because the working conditions became untenable. It's also telling that the ILC was unable to find another independent school teacher to replace me, Private school teachers are either too tired or too concerned about repercussions to speak comfortably about the absence of job protections. I spent virtually all my working adult life as a high school English, history, and art history teacher in independent schools. As a rule, teachers' working conditions and experiences in private schools vary widely at every level. What's universal to private school teachers' experiences is that their working conditions can change at any time and with no warning. Teachers are at the mercy of administrators and their whims, the parent family population. They are, after all, customers because of the tuition dollars that they pay, and shadowy boards of trustees. There's no recourse if new initiatives are undertaken that worsen working conditions. In terms of these working conditions, while it's true that there are some faculty unions at different private schools, most teachers have single-year at-will employment agreements that can be terminated at any time. How much the feeling like you could be let go at any time affects your attitude, quality of life, and ability to teach varies depending on the culture of the school, the support of other faculty members, and the competence of your administrators. Most of the time, you try not to think about it too much, unless a situation with a student, parent, or supervisor forces the issue. This happens all too often. If a student in your class does poorly and his parents are major donors, or if enough people complain about you behind your back, you can be out of a job without explanation. I saw it happen time and again to bewildered coworkers who hadn't quite learned how to negotiate the weird world of private schools. So, why would anyone choose to teach in a private school environment where there are no job protections? What are the benefits? So, kind of similar to charter schools, it's generally true that you don't need a teaching degree or official certification to teach in a private school. I was hired at my first school on the strength of my BA in English Literature and History of Art. Subsequent schools hired me on the strength of previous experiences and the quality of my discipline-specific graduate work. This can save time and money. You pick the stuff, but I would have benefited from training at the outset in the area of classroom management. That's the sort of thing that you pick up as you go, but your experience is really dependent on the willingness of your colleagues to mentor you. It's generally true that you will have smaller class sizes than you would have at a public school. Speaking as Ross now, I teach classrooms of like 30 to 35 students pretty regularly. But Susanna, I usually taught between 4 and 5 classes with 12 to 20 students. However, this fluctuates. Teaching 22 students in a classroom designed for 15 is a problem you just have to suck up because older private schools are often not equipped to handle rising student populations. Also, because schools market themselves to families as being smaller and therefore more equipped to provide individualized attention to students, also more rigorous academically, the amount of time you're required to spend providing feedback, cultivating relationships, and contributing to school culture in terms of like overseeing after-school activities, publications, chaperoning, etc., exceeds anything you might reasonably imagine for the salary that you're paid. So yes, relatively smaller class sizes, but the work required per student, per class, per day was pretty demanding. It's generally true that private school teachers have more autonomy in the classroom when it comes to determining curriculum. Each year I'd be given a list of texts to teach for a particular class, and be told that I needed to have X number of assignments per quarter, and then be left alone. I had to offer various electives, which is why I'd be able to teach classes like the films of Stanley Kubrick, Kafka and His Discontents, and why I could have 10th grade students read Raymond Williams during our Romantic Poets study. However, because there's no uniformity among teachers of the same subject, unless you and your colleagues decide there should be, you're vulnerable to criticism from your students about the perceived difficulties of classwork, grading policies, assessments, and their frequency, and so on. This wouldn't be a problem if administrators were willing to step in and shut that down, but in private schools, the customer is always right. The easier thing to do, if you're a feckless administrator, is either pressure the teacher into changing grades or simply change them with a registrar before report cards are sent home. This happened multiple times with her. Because there's no set curriculum for anything, you're mostly responsible for creating everything yourself. Unless you happen to have generous colleagues, I made it a point to leave behind all slides, handouts, assessments, annotations, readings, any other materials for anyone who would teach a certain class after I'd stopped. This is the fun part of teaching, but it can get overwhelming if no one provides you with resources or support. It's generally true that you don't have to worry about students passing standardized tests, whether they're state-mandated ones like the Regents, which is particular to New York State, or privately administered ones like the SAT or ACT. I was never expected to cede instructional time to test preparation, except for maybe AP Lit or AP Art History. Students do usually take something called the Independent School Entrance Exam, the ISEE, when they apply for private school admission, and complete applications that assess their training, writing, and math skills. These often don't factor in as much, determining whether a student is admitted to the school. Tellingly, and this is kind of similar again, students with IEPs were admitted with greater frequency, and those who had IEPs or lacked basic skills would be admitted because of the tuition dollars, and no support would be provided to us for considering how to help those students best. There are no sped teachers or departments at private schools asking administrators for resources on, say, how to best handle a disruptive kid who literally can't read, much less read the Odyssey with the rest of her class, would mostly elicit responses like figure it out, which basically meant inflating grades. In sum, what characterizes a private school teacher's working conditions and experiences is lack of consistency. You might get lucky and have great administrators who would understand the value of a stable schedule, small class sizes, and teachers who feel respected and supported in the face of seemingly unreasonable demands from parents. More often than not, however, you don't get that lucky.
Again, I'm Tom, the public school high school teacher. Currently teach ninth grade English on the Upper West Side. I guess I'm here to represent the sunny, more positive view of working conditions. I'm unionized. I work contractually fewer than 40 hours a week. I have paid vacations, 2 months off in the summer, abundant health care, a clean, climate-controlled classroom. I chose this job. It's actually, you know, it's very stable. And although there may be certain pressures that come that way, my way, from administrators or children or colleagues, it's a good living. I earn a middle-class wage. It's published on the internet. You can find out exactly what I earn based on the number of years I've served and the number of degrees I have. My union, in the United Federation of Teachers, makes sure that I am comfortable enough. That said, there are some downsides. One is maybe a sort of an emotional labor. You go into this profession not just because you want to have a good, steady job, but because you believe that there's value in it and that you care for the people you're educating. And this is both explicitly but more often implicitly weaponized to extract the maximum amount of labor from you. I can tell myself, let me work to rule. Let me just do the things that I have to do in the amount of time I have to do it. But then, what about the students who need the feedback? Or what about the class that needs covering because nobody showed up? What about the students who asked me if they could stay after school to make up the essay that I have to have them write in person? Because if I have them write it on a computer, I can't trust that it's theirs, and then they won't learn anything. And so in many different small ways, I find that the role, even of the well-protected public union educator, is one in which your desire to do good is pitted against your desire to have a life of your own. I will also say that I'm talking about my current working conditions. Last year, and a bit the year before, I was the target of a rather abusive administration. And because the evaluation system can be manipulated to say whatever they want it to say, I found that I was, despite being heavily protected by the union, just 1 year of bad observations away from being fired completely. 2 years of bad observations, you're out. And so, although I was still nominally protected, I felt a tremendous amount of pressure to start changing the way I was doing things, start doing extra, picking up more things, stop going to the union meetings that might raise their ire. And so it feels like lots of little small things that end up really having a big impact on my working conditions.
Yeah, so I thought maybe I should explain a bit unlike all the other panelists, I'm only a part-time educator, and what that entails. Although in game design, we often say that all game designers are educators because you have to educate the player. In terms of like educating people in a classroom, I'm only a part-time educator. Adjunct faculty are part-time professors, and so you teach at the university level, but it's not your only job. Typically, there's been this sort of adjunctification of higher education, and there are people who are like full-time adjuncts, is just sort of like a evidence of failure of the system, that like it's the intended use of a adjunct professor is from the university's perspective is ideally you're some form of landed gentry who has an independent income and can just teach a class as a lark. That's what they would really like. In practice, it typically means you have some other job, and that teaching is something that you're doing, you're electing to do. So I teach in an art school context, and it's very very common that everybody has a freelance commercial practice of some kind, and then teaching is a form of sort of stable income It's a lot more regular than a lot of artistic jobs can be, and it's where I get my healthcare. I teach two classes each semester, like fall and spring, but I only teach 6 hours a week, to 2 3-hour classes. So that's the starting point of being an adjunct, which has a lot of benefits. So on the pros of the working conditions is it's a really good job if you're like a kind of a weird person who doesn't want a normal job, it's pretty nice. You get to come in, teach a class, and then it's only 3 hours of your day, plus the commute, and so you can easily have another form of work. If you have a full-time job elsewhere, oftentimes we'll make allowances for people to teach, or anything else going on. And the requirements are surprisingly low, teaching in a private school or a charter school. Becoming a full-time professor, the hiring process is literally medieval. It's this multi-stage process that's famously lengthy and nobody likes. But being an adjunct professor is nominally it's do you have a terminal degree? So do you have a PhD or a master's in fine arts or something like that? But if you don't, if you're accomplished in your field, that will suffice as well. That's basically it. So you can just kind of come in and teach class, there's not really a lengthy requirements. Programs that I'm really familiar with and know some of the full-time faculty and stuff like that, easy enough to get a job. But even in programs where I didn't know anyone, I've never interviewed more than once for a teaching position. It's you've taught other classes, and so I guess you can teach here. it's nice, good work if you can get it. Lots of things that are really nice about it, and all the normal benefits of teaching. The hard parts of the negatives of the working conditions are a lot of the difficulties at the high school level. You see at the university level as well. Often there's no real institutionalized sort of onboarding or training. So lately I've been doing an interview series with other people who teach games at part-time. So other game designers in colleges across the country. And one of the things that comes up most frequently is that teaching a class is just sort of like, okay, well, like there might be a syllabus that you're handed, but it's probably bad, and there's probably nothing really of substance on it, and there's certainly no exercises or anything like that. And so the first time you're teaching a class, you're suddenly realizing like, oh, I've got like 3 hours of I need to have enough stuff to do for 3 hours once a week. It's a lot of time to fill. What am I going to do? It could be really stressful the first couple of times that you teach. That gets easier the more you teach, but adjunct professors tend to have really high turnover because it tends to be people who are in between other things. Most people don't continue teaching part-time for long periods of time. And so it has all of these, all of the issues that you think would come out of that. In addition to just all of the general working condition problems of modern higher education. Student expectations can be very high, especially since students don't know the difference between full-time faculty and adjunct faculty, and will often be very expectant that you respond to an email immediately, or can have office hours to meet with them and it's very difficult to explain, no, that's the full-time faculty who are paid to do that. I'm paid for the 3 hours I'm in the classroom and not a moment more. So any other time that's spent with a student is totally discretionary. And really feel what time is it. Both the games industry itself is like this, but education as well, of relying on the intrinsic value that you feel that your job has ends up being really nice from the administrator's perspective, because everyone who's teaching wants to do it. And so it's very easy for a university to kind of, any of the bad things that are happening, the person on the front line is the one who has to say, well, I'm not compensated to do this, but am I really going to not meet with a student who wants to talk about this thing? Of course you will. So all that feels like it's been baked into a budget somewhere of things that they're not paying us. My working conditions are much different than most part-time faculty in the U.S. are non-unionized. In part because it's particularly hard to unionize part-time workers. That's something we see even in an established union. My union's over 20 years old. It was once the largest faculty union in the U.S., but now it's like, I don't know, third or fourth or something. There's some bigger ones in California now. But it's still pretty recent for a union of educators that I think was one of the first unions of faculty of adjunct faculty, because it's very difficult to unionize when it's nobody's kind of full-time gig, and so that presents all these challenges. But it means that we have a bunch of we have a contract and sort of protections that most adjunct faculty don't have. So adjunct faculty in most New York schools will typically earn, depends on the subject, but it can be like $3,000 to $5,000 for a class, which is nothing, which sounds, it's a lot on a per hour basis. It's like, a couple hundred bucks an hour. If you were teaching like four classes a semester, which is a lot, it's not a it's not a livable income. You know, the amount of time that it's really kind of criminally low. At NYU and in the New School, it's like super complex how everything, but it ends up being, you know, like around $12,000 or $15,000 a class. So it's like easily triple or more what a non-unionized adjunct is going to work. And we have lots of job protections. We often have better job protections than the contract faculty, full-time faculty that we teach alongside. I have reappointment rights, so I'm like entitled to the classes that I teach because I've been working. You know, if you teach 4 years in a row or whatever, you get these reappointment rights. And so the school can get rid of me, but it has to pay me like a year's worth of my salary per class that they stopped giving me. So it's a pretty big penalty that they don't want to do. And so you have reappointment rights. Whereas full-time faculty, contract, non-tenured faculty are very easy to get rid of. And so having a union ends up sometimes this funny situation where you have better better job protections than the non-unionized but full-time faculty that we teach alongside. I think that's the other things that I think that all educators struggle with are always all the uncompensated labor that education entails is in terms of prep and grading and feedback. That the being in the classroom is like the easiest and also like smallest part of the job most of the time. Although our contract gives us, you know, we have like you get a little extra money to represent the fact that you have to grade outside of class, it still can never really encapsulate what it actually takes to work with people and teach them. Involves all of this labor that can end up eating so much of your time if you'll let it. I think that's common across all sorts of the educational spectrum, but is certainly true in the university level as well. Yeah, thank you.
So I'm, again, Lauren, and I work for Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. And I did mention that I am a full-time administrator. I'm the program director there. And I want to defend the administration at Brooklyn Institute against all of the other stereotypes and properly well-proven experiences of part-time, contingent, and full-time instructors in certain environments that we are small. We are very, very small. There's just three of us, and we make less than the instructors who do well. So just that aside, in fact, a lot of the instructors that work for our organization, myself included, work on a part-time basis. There are very few full-time faculty. What it means to be a full-time faculty at Brooklyn Institute is very different from what it means, I think, to be a full-time faculty at a regular university. But somebody like Alexander would be a very good representative of who are the majority of instructors who teach at Brooklyn Institute. And it might actually be worthwhile if I were to just ask for a hand raise if anyone in this room knows anything about the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, if you've heard of it, because it's a very different kind of structure. Yeah. Okay, a couple of people. So I'll take it just a minute to explain how it's different. It is a nonprofit. And it has, it is at once a nonprofit, but it is also not at all foundation funded. Philanthropic giving is about 15% of our total revenue, which is about $1.5 million annually. And students who come to learn with us do so not as students committing to a course of study. They come for an individual course. We have monthly, anywhere between 15 to 25 courses that we offer, and these are things you purchase. So we are very liable to market dynamics because we sell products, which are courses. And the way that we pay our faculty is by giving them 70% of all of the revenue generated by selling seats in their courses. So in an ideal kind of situation for faculty, we will sell out a course, and that portion of money that goes to the faculty teaching that course will be approximately, in a really good situation, about between $5,000 and $6,000 for the one course. The one course is 1 month long. So these are not semester courses. You have 12 hours in the classroom over 4 weeks. And so it works out to be what we consider to be a pretty decent wage for a kind of part-time endeavor. But most of the faculty who teach for us are really just that. They're part-time. And that means also that they don't have benefits from us. So we don't offer health insurance, and we can't also guarantee a certain income. So the opportunity to earn a good deal of money for a relatively smaller amount of work than a traditional semester is a promise. But it is also, we ask the faculty to carry the risk of maybe not selling out a course. So if a course isn't terribly popular, then a faculty might enroll minimum 5 students and find themselves really not earning quite a lot. One of the sort of just like practical consequences of this structure is that faculty who teach for us do not earn their primary living by teaching for us. There are a couple of people who we teach every month and they just love it, and many of our faculty really just love it. But a lot of our faculty do have either other adjunct positions or they have full-time jobs doing other things, teaching or not teaching. And the attraction for them of teaching with Brooklyn Institute, which I sometimes call BISR, Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, is that they have an opportunity to teach materials that are generally not considered to be part of standard curricula in traditional universities. So we had a course on like transgender Marxism, or we have courses on, you know, specifically dedicated to Saidiya Hartman. We have like, and these are all of the courses that we teach are also never assigned to faculty. So faculty really come to us, they propose a topic, and then we select from all of the options that have been proposed to create as broad and like diverse a curriculum on a month-to-month basis as we can. And so that's just kind of, that's kind of the situation in which faculty, so it is a self-selecting group, I should say, of faculty who can withstand the kind of income insecurity of teaching for us, but who also are attracted by the opportunity to teach maybe a little bit eccentrically to standard curriculum. Yeah, there's also a unique feature about these kinds of courses is that they're, you know, these are adult learners. So you have a multi-level classroom. You have some students who have some to no college, and you also have some students in a classroom who are PhDs or professors themselves. So one of the really interesting parts, I think, for faculty teaching there is that you really have to make the work that you do in a language that people can grasp. So like we have like a sort of a catchphrase, which is like accessible without rigorous yet accessible. And so I think a lot of faculty are really pleased to be working in an environment like this because you're actually, by bringing your vocabulary into a range that people can really like come to grips with, you're also reminding yourself of the use value of these materials. So people are enrolling in classes because they're a journalist and the course they've enrolled in is something they need to know about because they've been assigned a piece. Or you have an artist perhaps who's like working on something and they need to like get like a theoretical grip of something. So there's like, it's a really interesting, I think this is a broadly shared point of view among faculty. It's a really interesting place to work because the use of the materials you're teaching is very diverse, and it's also very real and very present in the classroom, in the way that the conversations happen around the materials. Apart from the kind of, you know, financial riskiness, I'm not sure exactly how to think about what are the challenges of the environment, because it does seem to me to be like kind of, I mean, I guess I'm like kind of a stan. It seems to be like a pretty good condition. Yeah, I guess maybe I'll just stop there.
My only comment would be to, I have a riposte to Tom. I don't think our working conditions are great. I'm just kidding. We actually didn't have working sinks in the teachers' bathrooms. So, you know, imagine having to go wash your hands in the water fountain. It was an adventure for a few months. But honestly, things have gotten a lot better. Like Tom said, there's AC. When we went to school, A lot of us had the box fan. You know what that was like. In any case, what is the quality of the educational product and or service? Because there might be some that disagree with that phrase product. But product and or service that you are delivering, how could it be improved? And we don't mean this from like the pedantic principle. How could you have improved your instruction? Right? I don't want to trigger anybody here. But just more like, how do you think that things could be different if certain impediments were taken away?
Yeah. So hi again, Michael, Charter Middle School. I'm a new teacher, so it's kind of hard to comment on the curriculum. Turns like what the kids are actually learning. But something I definitely want to comment on is like how the information is being delivered and the kind of like hurdles we got to jump through. There are two really big things that kind of go hand in hand with it. There is the difficulty in actually lesson planning at my school, and which also kind of comes off the back of the teacher's actual experience teaching that material. More specifically, at my school, we are kind of on all day. Our hours are from 7:15 till 4 o'clock, which is actually kind of short for charter school, I've come to learn, which is kind of crazy. But when we're not teaching, we are posted in the hallways. We're on hall monitor duty. We're making sure the kids are going to and from the bathroom, right to class. And it is really hard to lesson plan with four kids circling around you saying, oh, what'd you do this weekend? For 45 minutes every hour. You lose a lot of time that way. And with this being new material for a lot of people like myself, it gets really hard to deliver it in a way that is accessible to the students. Yeah, so specifically, I teach math. I teach special education math in my school. My degree is in science. I have to put a lot of effort to teach math. In my school, I'm curious to know what it's like for everyone else here. They don't always put you in a class you are going to have the easiest time teaching or you have the most experience in. They're going to put you in front of a class that you'll be okay in front of. It's quite funny. I had a friend at my school who was out for a day. She was sick and I had to cover science. I got the lesson plan packet. They put me in the room and it was the easiest class I taught all year. Never taught that before. It was the easiest class all year. I think that is a pretty good real world example of where the educational product is in my school and where it can be improved. I think spending more time with the teacher, getting to know what their specialty is before putting them in front of a class could really benefit them, both the teacher and the student.
Okay, cool. So again, as Susanna Grossman, private school teacher, ELA, here's how I taught the Canterbury Tales to 9th and 10th grade students.
Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall.